In 2021, there are three little words that will make most people cringe. Let's talk race. It's not because these are hateful words. It's because these words have so many different meanings, because there are so many conversations wrapped up in these words that most people don't know where to begin and are so scared of repercussions, they don't begin the conversation. Fern Johnson and Marlene Fine are two professors that got together to write Let's Talk Race, a guide for white people, starting the conversation from the comfort of your own home through the pages of a book that covers everything from seeing the varied forms of racism to understanding whiteness to even conversational do's and don'ts. Here is the full interview with both Fern Johnson and Marlene Fine, originally recorded Friday, April 23rd of 2021.
Good morning. This is Fern, and this is Marlene.
Hello, Fern, and hello, Marlene.
Hello.
Aha! Now we are all together.
Now we're all together. Great to be joining you.
Yes.
Well, excellent. So we can get right down to it. Both of you have worked on a book, Let's Talk Race, A Guide for White People. It's matter of fact, it's very blunt. It cuts right to the center of it. And so we can start off that way. Let's talk about race. We can talk, what exactly is race? Why? How is race different than ethnicity?
Oh, that's a pretty interesting question, you know, because it means different things depending on what country you're in, even sometimes what region you're in. But ethnicity has come to mean, in the United States, a distinction of whether you're Hispanic or you're not Hispanic. Now, most people think of their ethnicity as something else. Like I might say, you know, I'm Swedish and German background, or Marlene might say she's of, you know, Jewish background. So these are complicated issues. I think race for most people in the United States is a little more clear-cut, that we're usually talking about people who are distinguished on being African-American or black compared to white, people who are of Asian ancestries, various indigenous peoples. So these terms are a little more commonly understood. They get a little mixed up when they're put together with ethnicity, because you can be Hispanic and be white, and you can be Hispanic and be black. So, you know, this is a distinction not often clear.
But it's also really important to recognize that race is not a biological truism. There is no such thing as race. So there are greater genetic variations within groups than there are between groups. And so what scientists will tell you is that race is just something made up. And in fact, it was made up to ensure that certain people were denied rights. And it allowed, for example, people of color, Africans who were brought to the United States to be enslaved, and for white colonists to justify that enslavement. But what has happened over time is that race has turned into racism, and that's a reality in the lives of people of color.
So I want to tackle that a little bit more of what exactly race and racism is, but sometimes when I'm participating in a survey, it'll ask what my race or ethnicity is,
right.
And
yes,
it will give me the option of Caucasian, but yes, I'm not from the Caucasus Mountains at all. Why is that my identifier?
Yes. This is one of my pet peeves, because the continued use of the term Caucasian actually comes from one of the old classifications of race. And, you know, it again is a term that doesn't apply to most people who would define themselves, you know, culturally in the United States as white. Because, no, I'm not from the Caucasus either. But, you know, so it's a, you know, it's an old term that lingers, and it's used by some survey agencies. It's not used, for example, in the United States Census Bureau. Hasn't been used for a long time. I'm not even sure it ever was. So it's confusing.
It seems like there's a lot of, like the subject has been around for so long that a lot of these words continue into use, and we don't even know what terms or terminology we're even using. But when you mentioned before about race not really being an actual thing, so I guess race is a social construct then. It's something that we make up.
Yes.
But race has a visual identifier. It's based off the color of your skin, and from there you can classify people based on this artificial construct we've made up.
Well, I think there are two ways to think about that classification system. So from the outside, we classify others as different from us based on perhaps their skin color, or perhaps something about the facial structure. And then, of course, there's the issue of self-identification and how a person identifies himself or herself. So someone who is very light-skinned and black can self-identify as black or African-American, depending on one's background, but might not be identified by other people that way. So I remember teaching a class one time, and I don't even remember sort of what the conversation was about, but a young woman in the back of the class who was blue-eyed and blonde raised her hand and said, by the way, I'm a Native American. And there was this moment of, of course, we're making assumptions about the way people look, not the actual background that they might have.
And so,
yeah, I had an African-American colleague who had shockingly beautiful blue eyes. And people were always asking her about her blue eyes and that it was so unusual. And she said, well, you know what the ancestry is of African-Americans. You know, if they start from Africa, and then there are a lot of white people who got involved in the mix. So some of them had blue eyes.
It does get very confusing because it just kind of proves that you know nothing. Unless you ask someone actual questions about their background or their ancestry, you really don't know who someone is.
Yes, that is true. And I also think you've raised a question that has importance beyond just naming someone's ancestry. It's so important to ask people, for example, what names they want to be called. So, you know, are you identified as black? Are you African-American? Are you Afro-Caribbean? But I think, you know, whites all too often fear asking the question, and then they impose a name on someone that might not be the name another person chooses.
So as we continue this conversation, we've kind of hit on that there's different gradations of using these terms. There's black or African-American or Afro-Cuban, as you suggested, but there's one term for white people, and that's just white. You're white, your whiteness. So why are there different terms for whiteness, or is whiteness all just its own singular term?
I think these terms have washed over the population because they are used over and over again. Of course, there are lots of ethnic differences among people who are defined as white. The implications of being white and of ancestries that are not in the United States of African origin, I think, is the important issue. So a person who grew up with an ancestral linkage of African, you know, has a particular family history that has gone on now for centuries, has implications for their economic status, has implications for housing, for education. It doesn't mean it has the same exact implications, but those implications are very different than they would be for someone who's of, you know, Scandinavian, European background. So, you know, these are things that when we talk to people, we need to get more depth in, because somebody might, for example, think, oh, well, if, you know, African Americans are well educated and go to college and they have a great job, so So now we've leveled the playing field. Well, no, we haven't leveled the playing field. And we need to talk about why that is. We need to learn as white people more about the history that has led to what we have today. And we do that through conversation. You know, we tell our stories, we hear other people's stories, and then we can read, we can learn from many magnificent sources written by African Americans, many of them written by whites. But conversation is then how we link to other people to develop our, you know, empathy for current situation and where somebody has come from.
Well, you mentioned leveling the playing field, and one cultural phenomenon that seems to have prevented that leveling is white privilege. And that term has now become so politically loaded that anyone hears white privilege, they either don't know what it means or they immediately shut off any possible or future understanding of the word. But what exactly is this specter of white privilege that seems to follow white people wherever they go?
Well, we like to talk about the normalization of whiteness, and it's that normalization that leads to the privileges that we have as white people. So an example that Fern loves to use is about the difference between right-handers and left-handers. Mm. So I'm a left-hander, and I can't tell you how frustrating it is to live in a world in which almost every object is created for right-handed people. So I'm always at a disadvantage. When I was a child, I could never cut properly because, of course, my scissors were for right-handed children. In school, I was asked to learn to write as a right-hander rather than a left-hander because there were all of these stereotypes about how left-handed people were less smart, less intelligent than right-handed people. Mm. So now as we think about issues in terms of black people versus white people, we have a way of looking at the world that normalizes whiteness. Let me tell you one very quick story. I had a black woman in a dialogue I was doing one time talk about how her daughter, when she was about 12 years old, was in a dance recital, a ballet recital, and her ballet teacher said, "I want you to wear flesh-colored tights." So this woman and her daughter scoured the stores to find the right shade of brown tights that her daughter could wear. And of course, when she arrived at the recital, her dance teacher was aghast because flesh-colored, of course, meant the color of white skin, not the color of black skin.
Yeah, so the idea was that all the dancers' legs would be the same color. So the teacher didn't think about that. Just as I don't think all the time about what life for a left-hander might be like. You know, I just buy things, I do things, I have my water glass set on my right side, and, you know, I don't think about what happens to a left-handed person when they go out to dinner and then they have to reach over their plate to get, so there are all these little things that we don't have to think about as white people because they're normal, and we usually don't spend our days thinking about race.
And Fern and I thought we knew a whole lot about the concept of white privilege because we taught it in our classes. But it wasn't until we adopted our children. We have two sons who are African-American, who are adults now, but we adopted them as infants, that we really began to understand privilege. So just a quick example, we would be out wheeling our the first child that we had adopted, we'd be out taking a walk with him in his stroller, and people would come up to us and say to us, "You are such wonderful people, and he is such a lucky child." And we'd sort of look at each other and say, well, first of all, they're strangers. They don't know anything about what we're like. We might be horrible people. But then reverse the color of skin and imagine two black women out wheeling a white child, and the assumption would be they were the nannies. And in fact, one of our black friends told us she has a very light-skinned child. She was always mistaken for his nanny when she was out walking him.
So it seems like part of this is cultural expectation. And I don't mean to oversimplify with this analogy, but this is how I tend to understand the world. If I worked at an Italian restaurant and the number one cheese I'm using the most is mozzarella, and I go to another type of restaurant, let's say a Greek restaurant, they say pass the cheese, I'm going to instinctively go for the mozzarella because that's what I'm used to. But yeah, in a Greek restaurant, they're yeah, going to be using feta cheese or goat cheese. They're going to be using a different type of cheese. It has a
exactly,
different meaning.
Right, right. And, you know, I grew up in Minnesota, you know, and we ate Colby Longhorn cheese. And when I moved to Massachusetts, it was like, the supermarket doesn't have cheese. Well, of course, they had a lot of cheese, but they did not have what I was used to having, and I never had thought about that.
So for is white privilege something, like one of my favorite activities is taking a nightly stroll, and I don't think about that for a lot of people. They're not 6'2" strong white men, tall white men. They have to worry about perception. I don't have to worry about that. My small town has a very low crime rate. That's another privilege that I would have in enjoying evening strolls.
That's exactly right. That's a beautiful example of white privilege, that as a white person, we walk through the world not really thinking about or worried about how other people see us, for the most part. I mean, obviously, there are times when we worry about the perceptions of other people, but I don't fear as a white woman taking a stroll in my neighborhood. But one of our sons, for example, is spending a little time with us, and all of a sudden we realized that, you know, he has not been around. We live in a neighborhood that is relatively new for us, and, you know, there are people out there who have no idea who he is, and he's endangered. Or I grew up not ever really worried about being pulled over by the police. Not that I didn't worry that I might get a ticket, but nothing was ever going to happen to me. And in fact, as a young white woman, I could talk myself out of tickets. But we sure began to worry about that as our sons became old enough to drive a car.
And we had good reason to worry about it, because in fact, you know, they were surveilled by police when they were driving and pulled over. And we don't know a black man for whom mm-hmm. this has not happened.
Breaking this down a little bit further, breaking down racial intolerance, racial prejudice, is it thoughts of supremacy? Is it really for the people that believe in racism? Is it because of this deep-seated belief that they are somehow in their whiteness or whatever that may be, that they are better? Is it more of a knowledge problem? Is it just a lack of understanding? What exactly is building up this intolerance?
I think it's all of those things. You know, I like to use the phrase racial thinking, because there are so many things that we learn just as part of our daily living that are tied to race. And they're part of the way we categorize people, so that's part of it. Part of it is what we learn and don't learn in our education process. We learn very little about history at all, so that's the first problem. And then if you take African-American history, you know, as part of American history, it's really very, very little that we learn. So it really is all of those things. Marlene, you might have something.
Yeah, I would add to that I think there are some people in this country, and we have seen it in recent years. Look at the mob that stormed the Capitol in January. There are some people who explicitly do not like blacks. But for the most part, we're talking about well-meaning whites who don't recognize that we all hold deep-seated, sort of under-the-surface, tacit stereotypes about black people and other people of color. It's also the case that more often than not, when black people are talking about racism, they are not talking about individual racism. They're talking about systemic racism, institutional racism, the policies, the practices of particular institutions, the cultural norms that we hold as a society, all of which work against black people. And so we participate in that. As whites, we are always complicit in that system without realizing we're doing it. So it's not that, you know, we hold deep hatred in our hearts, but it's really that we're participating in a system that we have not spent time examining, understanding, learning about in ways that would allow us to move forward to really begin to dismantle racism.
I guess that's another term, but I would like to cover quickly systemic racism. And systemic racism, so the idea is that this is embedded within our very political structure, within our society. And I guess in order for racism to be so powerful as it is, there must be political groups that see racism and the idea of race and racial politics as a tool to garner more political power. Otherwise, it would never have continued on in this country for as long as it has.
Well, that's absolutely right. I mean, sometimes it's brute political power, but other times it is more complex than that. Hmm. For example, if we take redlining and the segregation of neighborhoods, not through legal segregation, but through other processes. Now, these were intentional processes that started in the early 1900s in urban areas to basically keep black people, Asian people, or, you know, people who weren't white out of certain neighborhoods. So they were really part of the lending system. They were part of the real estate system. And they were carried forward. So you look at the cities today, and you can look around and say, okay, this is where, I'll take my example of Minneapolis. I'm from a suburb. I knew as a kid growing up where black people lived. I knew where the Italians lived. I knew where, you know, Jews lived in the city. But what I didn't know is that this came into being through very, very specific practices and policies that started in 1910.
Hmm.
And one of my nephews suggested that I watch a documentary from Minnesota Public Broadcasting called Jim Crow in the North. And it focuses on Minneapolis and this huge project to document exactly how this neighborhood segregation occurred. So it's not politics in the sense that we think of, you know, brute political force, but it's politics in the sense of the politics of who is more important and who you want to exclude.
And so you see today segregated neighborhoods in major urban areas all across the United States as the result of many of these policies. That, of course, then leads to segregated schools across the United States. And then what you find is that those kinds of policies continue on to provide, you know, sort of the foundation, the basis of the wealth gap in the United States. And so it is the dismantling of all of that is so critical to dismantling racism, along with the dismantling of all of the underlying cultural assumptions and stereotypes that we hold.
So our society is still being haunted by decisions made more than 100 years ago.
Absolutely.
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 And we don't, most of us, understand this well. I mean, Marlene and I learned so much, you know, from writing the book. We learned so much over the decades of raising our children that we didn't know. And here we were, two professors whose research focused on racial issues. And we're still learning things. I mean, I am caught up short all the time by what I don't know or what I have incorrect. And this is our invitation to people to talk about these things. You know, there seems to be often a great reluctance to talk about race. You know, you might say the wrong thing. You might be accused of being a racist, or you just don't know. But people have got to come together in conversation, and they need to learn. And that is really a foundation for meaningful action to make changes toward racial justice.
Yeah, we really wrote this book for white people, and we thought that given our own experiences and the way that we've learned, the mistakes we've made along the way, that this would help other white people through the process. And we really saw the book as an invitation to begin a conversation. We also fundamentally believe, we're both communication professors, fundamentally believe that it is through talk, it is through conversation, it is through the telling of our stories that we come to know, to respect, to have empathy for, and ultimately to trust other people. And we cannot move forward as a country. We cannot move forward to dismantle racism, to make real significant policy changes until we have that kind of trust among each other.
Let's Talk Race, A Guide for White People, the new book by Fern Johnson and Marlene Fine. A wonderful tool to build that frame of reference, to build a lens and start just kind of shifting, a little cultural shifting, looking at things from a different perspective. Any other resources or websites where people can reach out to find out more about you both?
We have a website for the book that has a number of resources and some other information. It's www.letstalkrace.com. Pretty easy. www, the title of the book, letstalkrace.com.
And no hyphen in let's.
Right.
Oh, well, thank you both. It is an uncomfortable conversation, but as you stated, it's one that needs to be had, and it's one that can be had at almost any time of day.
Yes, it can. And thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, thanks for inviting us on your program.
Well, thank you for joining us, and have a magnificent weekend.
You too.
Take
care. Bye.
Let's Talk Race, A Guide for White People. Fern L. Johnson and Marlene G. Fine joined us in this conversation. Originally recorded Friday, April 23rd of 2021.